Hello out there, my friends. This is Tim Binal of BinalofAmerica.com with another edition of Binal of America Audio Season 2. It is October 28th, 2006, and we have for you a slam dunk edition of Binal of America Audio. The guest is Scott Corrales, author of Chupacabras and Other Mysteries and Flashpoint, High Strangeness in Puerto Rico. And the topic is Chupacabras, the mysterious beast that seemed to explode in the mid-90s, still lingers in esoterica, but you don't hear much about it nowadays. Scott and I go in-depth on the Chupacabra mystery, everything from the physical appearance and the traits of the Chupacabra, theories about what it is, the paranormal elements to the Chupacabra, the strange sociological aspect of that mid-90s Chupa wave in the Latin countries, Chupa migration, did it happen, and tons more Chupacabra eggs. We got Chupacabra hairs. We got more Chupacabra than you can shake a stick at. And it's all in this week's Binal of America Audio. Plus, if that's not enough, we're going to talk about Latin American ufology, Scott's early influences, the differences and similarities between Latin American ufology and U.S. ufology, why the Latin countries love NASA, why Mexico seems to be a UFO hotbed, and tons more in that regard as well. It's a jam-packed interview. We're covering a ton of material this week. Strap yourself in and get ready for a ride. If you're unfamiliar with Scott Corrales, let me give you a little bit of background on him. Scott Corrales became interested in the UFO phenomenon as a result of the heavy UFO activity where he lived in both Mexico and Puerto Rico. He was also influenced by Mexican ufologists Pedro Ferriz and Salvador Frejedo, a former Jesuit priest who advocated a paranormal interdimensional interpretation of the phenomenon. In 1990, Scott began translating the works of Frejedo into English, making the literature and research of experts and journalists available to English-reading audiences everywhere. This led to the creation of the Samizdat Journal in 1993, and his collaboration with Mexico's CEFP group, Puerto Rico's PRRG, and the foremost researchers of Spain's so-called third generation of UFO researchers. In 1995, Corrales documented the manifestations of the entity probably known as the Chupacabras in three works, The Chupacabras Diaries, Nemesis, The Chupacabras at Large, and Chupacabras and Other Mysteries. In 1998, the Samizdat Bulletin was replaced by Inexplicata, the Journal of Hispanic Ufology, as the official publication of the nascent Institute of Hispanic Ufology. In addition, Scott has been a guest on numerous radio shows, and his articles have been featured in several national publications. You can find out more information on Scott and check out a lot of his work at www.inexplicata.blogspot.com. Let me spell that out for you, inexplicata.blogspot.com. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on September 13th, 2006. Ladies and gentlemen, Scott Corrales on Binal of America Audio, Season 2. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Binal of America Audio. I want to welcome as my special guest this week, Scott Corrales. Scott has done a tremendous amount of research into Latin American esoterica, pretty much is the best way I can describe it, with a lot of emphasis on the UFO phenomenon and the Chupacabra, and a lot of high strangeness and paranormal activity that's going on in Latin countries. He's done a tremendous amount of work translating other researchers' work from those Latin American countries and bringing that research to the English-speaking audience, and that's a service that has just helped a ton for a lot of people here in the U.S. who want to find out more about what's going on in the world and are held back by that language barrier. Thankfully, he's done a lot of great work to open the doors to Latin American research for American researchers. And this week, we're going to be talking about the Chupacabra, which is something that I personally do not know too much about. I only really know about it in reputation alone, so I'm really glad we could bring somebody in here who's done some extensive research on the Chupacabra. And also, we'll be touching on a little bit of the Latin American UFO scene. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Scott Corrales to the show.
Good evening, Tim. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Terrific, thanks.
I should also mention that Scott has two books out, Chupacabras and Other Mysteries, and also Flashpoint, High Strangeness in Puerto Rico. And you can find out more information and get information from him at inexplicata.blogspot.com. And let me read that out and spell it for you. inexplicata.blogspot.com. That's correct, right?
That's correct.
Awesome, awesome. Well, let's start out with your background and your bio and how you came to study the paranormal in general.
Well, I guess it has to go right back to my parents moving to Mexico in the early 70s, when the country was going through a significant amount of UFO and paranormal activity. Unlike, I'm guessing, the attitude, the more skeptical attitude that people felt in the States, at that time in Mexico, people were much more open about the subject. I was just in grade school at the time, and my teachers were actively encouraging us to read up on it. Magazines were being recommended. Newspaper clippings were being provided.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's... There was the idea. I guess back then people actually thought, you know, the space program meaning so much more in Latin America, I think, than it did in the States, that people felt, well, now we're going out to space. We're going to be meeting extraterrestrials. So isn't this great? By the time you kids all grow up, you will have people from other planets, like tourists, walking up and down the streets. And that was
yeah,
basically the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very healthy to keep, you know, to have people at the time with such open minds among the adults. No one ever censored what I was reading. Grown-ups were always providing me a lot of the books that I still have to the present. Were given to me when I was a kid, so it's very good memories.
Nice, nice. I think I was more laughing at how disappointing the future has turned out.
Yeah, quite.
And now, in one of the bios I read on you, it said you were highly influenced by two men in particular, and I wanted to ask you about them. It's always important, I think, to, you know, put over the early influences and talk about your mentors type of situation. Pedro Ferriz and Salvador Frejedo. Can you, and I probably mispronounced those names terribly, but...
No, that's quite all right. That's Pedro Feliz and Salvador Frejedo. Yes, they were two giants of their time. Pedro Feliz was a Mexican newscaster of his day,
mm-hmm,
who had one of the very first shows in Spanish language television. It was called Otro Mundo Nos Vigila, Another World is Watching. And he was very much very active believer in the UFO, the extraterrestrial hypothesis of the UFO phenomenon.
Yeah.
Published books, had magazine articles. He was very much like, I'm trying to give you a good example, perhaps more of like a Major Donald Kehoe figure in Mexico, someone like that.
Okay.
No, more like a Frank Edwards figure.
Oh, okay, yeah. All right.
In Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Like a media-oriented...
Absolutely. Very much of a media man. I think his show was on Channel 5 in Mexico, if I remember correctly. Now, Salvador Frejedo is certainly one of the giants of Spanish and Latin American ufology. He's a former Jesuit priest who left the Jesuit order in 1968 after questioning the church. One of his interests happened to be parapsychology, and the road the road through parapsychology led to UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote some very insightful books in the early 70s. One of them was Defendámonos de los Dioses, Defying the Gods, or Let Us Defend Ourselves Against the Gods. That's two possible translations for the title. That book worked. It didn't borrow heavily, but I think it was influenced by John Keel's own take on the paranormal reality behind the UFO phenomenon. It borrowed from Charles Fort's vision that we are property. In turn, it influenced other authors. I believe he influenced the authors of a British book called The Dark Gods directly. So he's been very much a controversial figure, especially now that the UFO field in Spain and Latin America has become much more skeptical, much more given to naysaying, and not quite so open-minded.
Oh, wow. Okay. We're going to have to talk about that change in attitude when we get to Latin American ufology, because that sounds fascinating. And how did you end up focusing on the Chupacabra? How did that come out of your UFO studies?
Well, I think that if you look at the... my little flyleaf to the prologue of Chupacabras and Other Mysteries, I mentioned something about having been very much influenced by the Mothman Prophecies, John Keel.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw it, when I saw the book, I picked it up at a drugstore in San Juan, Puerto Rico in 1975. And the idea that these creatures clearly denizens of another reality of some sort seem to be able to come into our own reality and interact and then vanish, then come back, and so forth. It really stuck to me. And at that time, I think for a number of years after that, I kept, files, clippings on Bigfoot and other strange creatures, a lizard man of North Carolina. And throughout the 70s, I mean, even living in Puerto Rico, there we had been, well, not quite under the shadow, but I mean, the media influence was tremendous, of a creature called the Mocha Vampire. Mm-hmm. And tasty though that may sound, Mocha is actually a little town in Puerto Rico on the Mona Channel, the body of water separating Puerto Rico from Santo Domingo.
Okay.
And back in 74, 75, there was a wave of cattle mutilations by this creature that was never, ever seen. People always saw its handiwork. They saw the dead rabbits, the dead horses, the mutilated mares, they saw everything, but no one ever saw the creature. So you had this shadowy phantom that committed these delinquent acts, shall we call them, always in the background. So 20 years later, almost 20 years to the day, when you start getting the chupacabras, I already had, let's say, all the background information I needed to launch myself into this particular set of apparitions, and which I'll just throw his name in there again, Salvador Freixedo, had researched while he lived in Puerto Rico in 1974-75. So there was a lot of his work to use as a springboard into the current, the then current events.
Okay. And now, for the folks who are kind of vaguely unfamiliar, like me, with the chupacabra, there's an awesome picture or drawing, I guess, of the chupacabra in the book that is just freaky. Could you describe the chupacabra's physical appearance and pretty much like what it's mostly known for, which is like attacking and killing and sucking the blood from livestock and things like that? But give us a rundown of the physical description of the chupacabra.
Well, that the drawing you referred to in the book is a famous drawing based on eyewitness Madeline Tolentino's close-up sighting of the creature. She had it; she was looking at it from the other side of either a window or an iron gate. Mm-hmm. So she was actually had it right there in front of her.
Wow!
The creature has been variously described as having a humanoid body with very powerful kangaroo-type legs, and a humanoid head that has been identified as, well, described as being reminiscent as the head of one of the gray aliens that were so popular in 90s UFO iconography.
Yeah.
Chupacabras also has a crest of either spines or fluttering appendages running down from the crest of its head all the way down its back. Some people have reported a thin membrane under its spindly arms that don't appear to act as wings, but do seem to aid it in levitation. People have seen chupacabras levitate and float, but never actually fly, by which I mean it doesn't flap its arms to fly.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit more about those phosphorescent spine appendages? Because I thought that was really strange. I mean, the other stuff I've heard of somewhere else, at least.
Well, it is interesting because you do have the descriptions that range from people having daylight sightings where the spines are not noticeable, and nighttime sightings where people said they glowed, they fluttered, they made noise. So this is certainly one of the salient characteristics of chupacabras, along with its huge penetrating eyes, which I forgot to mention.
Yeah.
The thing is, when we mention the appendages and the membrane under the arms, I have to stress the creature as described is much too heavy to be said to fly. It floats, it levitates. In one case, it was seen being as though jerked straight up into the air by an invisible force. But no one has ever said the thing actually flies.
Now, you talked about the Mocha Vampire of the 70s. And I've heard various different stories here, so maybe you can kind of clear this up a little bit. Was there a history of the chupacabra
not just in Puerto Rico, but also like in the Latin American countries, or in the esoteric field in general, before it sort of burst onto the scene in the mid-1990s?
Well, there's three possible answers to that. One answer, yes, the lore of the Taino Indians who lived in Puerto Rico included a number of scary creatures. One of them was called the Maboya. And this creature was never really described. I think the priests who spoke to the Indians at the time said they held it in such terrible fear and reverence, they couldn't even describe it. But it was something scary enough to keep them inside their huts at night. That could have been an early description of chupacabras. As for the rest of Latin America, with all the different cultures and civilizations that existed from Mexico down to Argentina, you do have stories of frightening creatures. You have even some possibilities suggested in Brazil that chupacabras-like creatures may have even been worshipped.
Oh, wow.
By insect-venerating cultures of the South American Altiplano, the High Plateau, mm-hmm. as it's called. But now that leads us down to another series of conjectures that takes us away from your question, which is, could chupacabras be an insect? A lot of people have looked into the possibility. They say yes. They say that it emits a smell that's chemical, that could be related to formic acid, what ants produce. It has left a liquid that we call chupacabra's blood, but it's much more like hemolymph, the substance you find in insects.
Huh.
Some people have said chupacabra's just a giant praying mantis that feeds on soft tissue and blood. I mean, once we start going down that way, it becomes a different ballgame. I mean, that's... but to remain on track, so to speak, yes, you could say that there were some cultures that could have had a background for chupacabras. But as I said, the phenomenon emerged in Puerto Rico, and the Taino Indians did have the Maboya, and there's a periodicity that some have observed, that I have observed at least. There were chupacabra sightings back in the 1950s. Again, the mutilations, no creature. Mocha Vampire, 1975, mutilations, no creature. Chupacabras, 1995, mutilations and creature. So with this 20-odd year repetition of events, we can expect another outbreak in 2015 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
So the trick is to stay alive and see if we actually get a chance to put that to the test.
Now, is there any reasoning you think behind this 20-year window between chupacabra flaps?
It would be interesting to think that the creature, if we're talking about a flesh and blood creature, that it hibernates, or that like cicadas, they hatch after a certain number of years, it appears, it feeds, it goes back into its cave dwelling, wherever that happens to be, lays eggs, and then those eggs will hatch and we'll have chupacabras all over again. I'm much more of a believer, this is my reputation, of having found more of a paranormal answer to things. And I would think that perhaps there are certain windows that appear as Earth and our solar system traverse through the universe, as Earth goes around the sun certain times, I don't know.
Yeah.
That these windows are open and the possibility exists for these creatures to come through. As living here in Pennsylvania, I mean, we have appearances of Bigfoot that appear to be, you know, regulated by some strange mechanism we can't tell.
Yeah. And then sort of talking about this big chupacabra flap that happened in the 1990s, talk a little bit about how it was just such an explosion on the scene of Puerto Rico, because when I was reading your book, I was really struck by just how pervasive the reports were. And, you know, sitting here and hearing about the chupacabra, you think that maybe there's a sighting like, you know, once a month or something, but then when you're reading the book, it's like, Every day there's a chupacabra sighting going on during this period of time. Talk a little bit about that sort of chupacabra hysteria that was going on in Puerto Rico when this happened.
And I think hysteria is a very, very good word for it. But you had the social phenomenon at the same time, people using chupacabras for advertising, for promotion. people coming on your TV set just to say chupacabras for no reason, then they would cut to another commercial. So there was all this going on, all the T-shirts, the balloons, the pop songs, all the cultural madness that happened. That's undeniable. So it's easy for me to see now, you know, with 10, 11 years hindsight, how people thought this is all, you know, crazy Hispanic madness. They've made all this stuff up. Because, yeah, at one point you were completely overwhelmed by it. But now, more seriously, you have to think that Puerto Rico had been undergoing, since 1987 or 88, a very, very, very intense UFO wave.
Mm-hmm.
It had continued unbroken all those years. In fact, the year 1994, right before the Chupacabras appeared, had been incredibly active, full of sightings of different kinds, different parts of the island. Southwestern Puerto Rico, Laguna Cartagena, had been visited by people from all over the world who believed there was a UFO base of some sort under that lake. It's a very shallow lagoon. Obviously, there couldn't be anything under it, but people thought it might be some kind of dematerialization point. So a year after this, you start getting reports in March of 1995, if memory serves, of strange creatures in the trees in central Puerto Rico, in the district of Orocovis, which is in the mountains at the center of the island.
Mm-hmm.
These creatures looked like half reptilian, half gray alien creatures. They were in the trees. They appeared to have hypnotic powers. People had to fight to wrest themselves from that kind of hypnotic grip that these things seem to have. Then, by the month of May 1995, we were getting reports of giant birds. Usually, Puerto Rico has had reports of giant birds going back decades. Huge winged birds. One of them got into a fight with a night watchman. A sugarcane cutter died of a heart attack when he saw one of these birds.
Wow.
That time. So now, these strange, high strangeness events
mm-hmm.
continue to occur throughout the summer of 1995 until in August of 1995 you start getting the very first appearance of chupacabras as we've come to know it in Canovanas, which is in northeastern Puerto Rico. That's when Miss Tolentino and her husband actually saw the creature. And by that point, the manifestations of the creature became so regular in Canovanas that people waiting for the bus in daylight were actually seeing it. They were seeing it bounce around, you know, hopping around the streets.
Wow.
And they were just referring to it as el conejo, the rabbit, or el canguro, the kangaroo, because it would hop around. Were they afraid? Yes. Afraid enough that Mayor Jose Chemo Soto decided to take matters into his own hands when he saw that the police were not going to do anything about it. He organized his infamous posse of 200 volunteers, and these guys went out in the night looking for chupacabras. They were looking in caves, in trees. They were looking in storm drains. They were looking for it everywhere.
Yeah.
And they did have a couple of encounters with it, I think down by one of the riversides in Canovanas. But the photo of Chemo that went around the world was the image of him in his camo. I mean, he's a former National Guard reserve, standing next to this huge cage made of welded, I can't describe, but these are like the iron bars that people use to protect their homes down there.
Yeah.
They had just welded this cage together. They said, well, we're just going to put it there, put a little goat in it, catch chupacabras, and we're going to be famous.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was part of their heroic efforts, I should say. But by that point, you're talking October 95, the manifestations of the creature were, as you say, on a daily basis occurring not only in Canovanas, but in Aguas Buenas, which is closer inland, out in Fajardo on the eastern coast of the island. Now you started to get cases in the south and western corners of the island. So the activity by October, November 95 was a series of daily occurrences. Of course, no one ever took the subject seriously until a number of horses belonging to island congressmen were mutilated. And that's when I think a motion went up in the Puerto Rican Congress to have formal investigations on the chupacabras. As I said, once wealthy people were affected, it suddenly became frighteningly real.
Yeah. And what was the take on the Chupacabra when the Congress investigated it down there in Puerto Rico? What did they come out deciding?
Well, this is the problem. There was never an official investigation. There was a call for an official investigation. Much as 20-odd years earlier, the Congress in Puerto Rico had called for a formal resolution demanding an answer, an explanation to the UFO phenomenon that was bedeviling the island at the time in throughout the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And it was a resolution that I think some people felt it was ridiculous, that it would call ridicule upon that particular Congress and the legislative body as a whole. The idea was to have the civil defense go ahead and organize its own investigation, produce its own report. In fact, the man in charge of producing that report, a man named Wisbel Ayala, told me in, I think this would have been January, February 1997, that he was 2 weeks away from finishing his report. It's now, September 2006. I'm still waiting for that report. So nothing formal ever came from the request made by the authorities.
And one of the things that strikes me about the Chupacabra is that it's very different from your typical cryptozoological beast in that it is highly aggressive. We've sort of touched on the fact that's its main claim to fame, apparently, is that it's a super aggressive cryptozoological beast. And with the exception of maybe the East Coast Pennsylvania area Bigfoots that are kind of noted for being aggressive, you don't really see that in too many other cryptozoological animals.
You know, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. But yes, we see chupacabras as aggressive, not as much for the mutilations. I mean, we've had cattle mutilations in the U.S. That are just as bloody. But those particular cases, I mean, the animals that were completely exsanguinated from September 95 through early 97, they do show, let's say, a very dedicated predator.
Yeah.
That will stop at nothing. Now, why didn't I think considered aggressive? Well, because there were no real documented attacks on humans. There was two cases in Mexico, Teodora Ayala, a woman from the state of Sinaloa, being the first case of an attack. She was leaving her house at night, was scratched by the creature. Then another man claimed that he was attacked. So you have two cases involving a shadowy creature that attacked two people in 1997, but not in Puerto Rico, in Mexico.
Yeah.
The other chupacabras attack that comes to mind, not really, it wasn't even chupacabras attack, it was a strange winged entity attack, was a couple of years ago in Chile, where a man coming back from, I think, a relative's house was attacked on a bridge by two winged entities. And he had to jump into the river to get away from them. But I guess with Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, people have seen, well, they exist, they may not exist, but whatever they are, they don't seem to have dark designs upon human beings.
Yeah.
But Chupacabras is proactive, let's say. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit about the perceived migration of the Chupacabra, because like in your book, it sort of talks about how the Chupacabra sightings were really big and really reported in Puerto Rico. Then all of a sudden, the Chupacabra started popping up all over the place through Latin America and Chile, especially in Brazil and Mexico, and then eventually southwestern United States. Can you talk a little bit about how this migration seemed to happen, and do you think it was an actual migration of the Chupacabra, or was it merely a migration of reportings of sightings of Chupacabras?
Now, that's a good question. I think that if you try to follow the, let's call it the migratory pattern, mm-hmm. Assuming it was a migration, you had all your cases in Puerto Rico running from 95 to 97. That was like the odd 18-month window that seemed to characterize some of the Mothman episodes in the stateside.
Yeah.
There appears to be a certain number of time that these entities are able to manifest themselves. But as the sightings slowed down in Puerto Rico, they picked up, first of all, in Miami, where you had your incidents in the month of May of 96. That very same month, you started having incidents in Mexico, in two different parts of Mexico. You had sightings and animal mutilations in Veracruz, and then you had other events in Sinaloa on the Pacific coast. So at the same time, these are happening. You start getting reports heading down to south into Central America. You have Dr. Oscar Garcia from Guatemala reporting events in central Guatemala where the creature appeared to leave a very strong radioactive signal wherever it went. Wherever he found prints, wherever he found this strange hemolymph or chupacabra's blood, he would find traces of radiation as well. It started manifesting itself in Costa Rica, where anthropologists said that this was all a delusion, and it had much to do with, I guess, they gave it a Marxist reading. Chupacabras was unbridled capitalism exploiting people, you know, you can imagine.
Yeah.
By then, now you're moving into 1997, you have events in the American Southwest, you have all your cases along Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, but more interestingly, you start having mutilations on the other side of the ocean. You start getting your cases in Portugal and Spain.
Wow.
And those, interestingly enough, the Chupacabras creature was not seen. They saw a mandrill-like entity at one point, and that mandrill-like entity would become common in the Chile sightings of the year 2000. So you have a number of events going on, so you can't really say that this creature, as the press suggested, had left Puerto Rico and was going elsewhere. It seems that spontaneous generation was taking place over the course of these 18 to 24 months in a number of places.
For those of us who are zoologically impaired, what is exactly a mandrill-like creature?
Well, the creature that was reported in Spain in 97 was described as a mandrill, looking more like an ape than anything else.
Okay.
Clearly an out-of-place creature for Spain.
Yeah.
However, you can take into consideration that there are Bigfoot sightings in the Pyrenees, the mountain range between Spain and France. So it could have been something along that order of being. I mean, we don't know.
Yeah.
The fact remains that from 1996 to 97, 1,267 sheepdogs, and horses were killed in Spain by mutilation, by exsanguination, I should say. So something was very active in that time period there. As I said, when we start looking at the body counts in this rather limited time frame, you come up with amazing numbers. I mean, look, Brazil, 837 animal deaths in 1997 alone.
Wow.
Chile, 1,461 birds, poultry alone. Puerto Rico, we've come up with just guesstimates of between 1,000 to 2,000 animals between 1995 and 2002.
Wow.
So whatever whatever they say, well, you know, it doesn't exist, it's a phantom of the Hispanic imagination, it's this, that, and the other, the mute testament is the predation. Those are the creatures, those are the people who lost pets, people who had a livelihood, people who were set back financially in very poor countries. And in fact, it was only one Chilean senator in the early 2000s who said, look, let's forget about where the creature came from or what it's doing. Let's talk about the fact that people have lost livelihoods. Let's do something about it. Let's not say this dogs did this when dogs clearly didn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And could you talk a little bit about some of the more paranormal elements of the Chupacabra, especially sort of like this interdimensionality to it?
Well, let's begin by saying that the Chupacabras has the ability to just appear and disappear out of nowhere, first of all. People never see it arrive. They see it either there, they see it, you know, just suddenly it wasn't there, then there it was.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we say?
Yeah.
It can fly, it can levitate, float, go off somewhere, but never you can never see it take off.
Yeah.
There was a pastor of a Protestant church in Puerto Rico, this bird daylight sighting. He was driving his little van, I think, with people from his church. They see the Chupacabras in the middle of the road, and suddenly it is jerked upward straight into the air,
Wow.
Heart attacks all over. They look, they can't see anything. So when it comes to the paranormal aspect, you start getting strange. Well, let's say that it ties in with the belief that you have creatures that can somehow come in from a shadowy dimension that's beside our own, from other levels of existence, that they can remain in our reality for limited periods of time. A year, 18 months, no more than that. And that usually, you can see that the events, the mutilations, extinguish themselves after the period of time. They can pick up again. But it seems these beings can only remain with us for a certain amount of time, suggesting that they're able to drift into our reality then go back to their own.
Yeah. Or maybe even that they get stuck in the reality.
Could be. They could get stuck in our own, but then I guess we'd start finding more remains than we actually have. Who knows?
Yeah.
But there's an interesting detail in the Brazilian cases that took place in 1998. Most of that year, Chupacabra activity seemed to be taking place in Brazil for some reason or the other. There were cases of the mutilated animals being found deep inside caves. Let's say farmers would miss sheep, goats, you name it, and these animals would turn up deep inside caves.
Huh.
Caves that were known as being places where, I guess, materializations occurred.
Weird.
So, you know, this is all anecdotal, obviously. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stop people from wondering, you know, are we dealing with something clearly, that's clearly solid, that can cause effects in our reality, but yet seems insubstantial at the same time?